Hi, I'm Steve.
Hi, Steve.
I was hoping for a smaller crowd. Thanks, Linda. Appreciate your share, wherever you went. Nobody really in their right mind signs up to do this. So I work on Saturdays, and I was talking to a customer client today, and she's the end of the time we met together, she said, hey, what are you doing tonight, Saturday night? And I said, I'm speaking in an Al-Anon meeting. And she goes, that doesn't sound like fun. I go, no, we're really fun, right? You know, we have a great time together. I was trying to get to the dentist to get a root canal instead, you know, but here we are. My sponsor said, you know, get up here and tell them a joke. It's a recovery-based joke. And I said, are you sure? And he said, sure. Tell him I told you to do it. I said, that's what we do, blame our sponsors, right? So he said, what do you call it? He told me this. What do you call it when Al-Anon worries, ruminates, and obsesses? Yeah. Foreplay. Oh. True, huh? There we go. So I'm going to try and, gosh, so much stuff, Kim, so part of my, first of all, you've heard of adult child of alcoholics. I am an adult child of an untreated Al-Anon. So when they talk about this disease being contagious, you know, generation to generation, I'm living proof of that. My brothers are too. And you do not need a drinker to get this disease. And I think there's enough research on it to articulate that, enough of our writings that talk about it as well. So I'm going to talk about some of that. I'm going to fly through as much of this as I can. So I've been in program. I got my 25-year chip. Well, I got it last week or last month, but I got it in February, so I've been here 25 years. Thanks. And I want you to know, for those of you who haven't been around a real long time, Alan and AA did not used to do anything together. Years ago, we did not cross-pollinate, you know, we did not, you know, they had their thing, we had our thing, and then slowly it started, you know, like you can come here and put up a literature table, but you can't talk to anybody, you know, you can't sell anything. No, it wasn't that bad, but at any rate, so what happened is about 20 years ago, I got approached by an AA person. And I guess every Christmas, you know, up in Benicia, there's this big armory. I don't know if you guys have been. It's a huge, cavernous place. So I guess, I don't know if they're still doing it, but back then they were. At Christmas time, they had this huge speaker meeting. They'd get 300 to 500 people, sometimes more than that. They had a dance. You get that? Al-Anon's a dance, you know? We don't dance. We don't. And at least not publicly. So they said, well, would you come and represent Al-Anon and speak at this thing? You know, I've never heard of an Al-Anon speaking at an AA function. So as an AA person, she said, yeah, well, we'd like you to do that. So I said, okay, talk to my sponsor like we do, right? What should I do? He says, are you busy? No, go speak. Okay. Yeah. You know, do what we tell you to do. So I go up there, and I hadn't spoken much in program, and so I get there, and this place is packed with AAs, and they're laughing, and they're fun, and there's music, and, you know, and all that stuff. And so the person who invited me comes up to me and says, she described her, what she was wearing, you know, on the cell phone. I said, okay. I found her, and she says, she introduced herself and said, you know, are you nervous? And I said, well, yeah, I'm always a little nervous, you know. And she says, well, this is the first time we've ever allowed Al-Anon in this function. And I'm going, oh, crap, you know. I thought, I didn't know I was groundbreaker here. I didn't sign up for this. So I get in there, and there's like, oh, my God. And I get up, and I walk to the front of the room, and it's kind of dark. And, you know how Al-Anons feel about AA is like they don't like us, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm looking out there, and there's 500 eyes that are boring in on me. Just talk about your drinking. Talk about my drinking. Go ahead. So I didn't, but I talked about my disease instead. And it went okay. I was really glad it was over. And they had a big long buffet. You know, people walked through and they served themselves, and it was pretty cool. So I walk up there, and then I'm conscious of this person next to me, and I kind of look over there. I'm scooping salad or whatever it is, and he's a big tall guy and looks like a Texan. He's got one of those Western coats, you know, the cut is that way, and he's got a big white hat on, and he's like 6'3", and he's a big guy. And so I'm, hi, how are you? And he says, I'm fine. Or, you know, in his accent, I'm fine, you know. So I'm just scooping my stuff, and I catch him looking at me, and he said, "You're that Al-Anon speaker, aren't you?"
He did.
I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I've never really talked to an Al-Anon before, and I've never talked to an Al-Anon man." And then he reaches over and puts his hand on my shoulder, because I'm like 5'8", he's 6'4", or whatever, and he says, "But it's okay, you're sicker than I am." I made it! I got through, yay! So anyway, so how I came to you, I don't know where to jump around in my story, but I came to you by a treatment center, probably 28-30 years ago, and I was married at the time. I'm no longer married to a wonderful woman. She's one of the best people I've ever met in my life, maybe the very best. And she happened to have alcoholism, which I didn't know because she didn't drink. She drank maybe 3 times in the time we were married. We were married 20 years before she started drinking, and she has the gene. And I did not know any of this until I came into Al-Anon and started reading everything I get my hands on, reading literature, and understand that this is, for the drinker, it's a genetic disease. But I was skeptical about that. But, we were doing, by that time, I was in deep despair. I didn't care if I lived or died. I was depressed. I was going to therapy. I was going to support groups, trying to get her to do anything to stop because, she was everything to me. Linda talked about the solution. And for me, she was my solution. She was a drink with two legs. And, when she started drinking, it was horrible. And I did everything that you read about. I'd yell at her, I'd scream at her, I'd cry, I'd follow her around. I'd, do the kiss and sniff when I come home from work, master that one. Then ask those meaningful questions. I smelled the alcohol, but I got to ask her, right? "Have you been drinking?" "No." And I go, "Well, I smell alcohol in your breath." She says, "Nope." So I need to ask her again, right? Al-Anon's, if you do it once, it doesn't work. You do it 20 more times. Put the key in the lock. "You sure?" "I smell it. Watch your breath." Nope. And, and I'd hunt for bottles, and I'd find a bottle and I'd go, "What's this?" And I'd embarrass her and I'd see the shame in her eyes. Didn't know what I was doing to her. I had no idea. That's what Al-Anon is so good at, is educating us about how the disease gets perpetuated dynamically, whether there's the liquid or not. And I told my sponsor, I was listening to these tapes and, I was immersed in Al-Anon, before I got her into treatment. And I did get her into treatment. And so I found bottles and I had bottle hunter and I listened to the speaker and he was a bottle hunter. And she was a bottle hider, he was a bottle hunter. And I said, "Yeah, I'm a bottle hunter." I told my sponsor, and I said, I'm feeling pretty relieved because I'm not the only one doing it. It's normal. And he says, "It's common, but it's not normal." Right. And, and I would do all that stuff. At one time, this is how sick and crazy I was. I videotaped her walking around drunk. And the next day, because I was hopeless, nothing was working. I tried everything. Pre-programmed, tried everything that did not work. Videotaped her, sat her down the next day. I said, she says, "What are you doing?" I said, "You're going to watch this videotape of you. This is what I'm seeing every day. This is what you're doing to yourself. This is what you're doing to me." She says, "I don't want to watch it. I don't want to watch it." I said, "Yeah, you're going to sit down and watch it. Sit down." And she did. Boundary violation, right? Right here. Trying to force a solution, right here. And she watches it, and I noticed her start to cry. And I thought, this is probably not going very well. So I stopped it, and I said, "Never mind." But that's the kind of things I did. And I was desperate, and she was destroying herself. She was a woman who never got arrested. She was a total rule follower. She was just, supportive of law enforcement and the people who did that kind of work. She never ever got a ticket, never got arrested, nothing. But when she drank, her presentation totally changed. And, and I'd come home. The first time I noticed it was a problem, came home in the middle of the afternoon from work, hit the garage door opener, and there she is on the garage door floor. And I went, "Oh my God, she's dead." And she had vomited, she had aspirated all over herself, and what is this? And she was drunk. And then it accelerated from there. When they say it's a progressive disease, that's what it is. And that happened, so I decided to do an intervention. That's me. Called her parents, we're going to get over here. She was a binge drinker, so she would stay drunk for 3 days to 3 months. You know, 0.20, 0.25 when we had her hospitalized. Reaching the fatal levels, you know, so we bushwhacked her. Took her up to St. Helena. I called St. Helena, made the reservation for her. Because she couldn't do this, you know. And I didn't want to see her die, so I had to do something. So I take her up to St. Helena with her family in the car, and she's crying, and she's ashamed, and she's going through withdrawals and all that horrible stuff that we witness, right? Suffering in way, and I feel like she's doing this to me. You know, that's my thinking. So I get her up there, we check her in, they take the family off to one side, they got a room, right? These treatment facilities, this place is a really good place in Napa Valley. They have a hospital wing, so another lesson in working with the disease is they take all alcoholics and medically detox them first. That's what they're supposed to do. That's the prescribed treatment. So they did that for her. They were going to do that for her, took the alcoholics away, took the families to a room, talked to us. You could tell it was the families because we were all morose and the A's were over there having a party or whatever they were doing. And I said, you know, and I talked to the person there and I said, what, you know, I don't understand, you know, where are they going? Where are they going into treatment? Do we get to say goodbye? No, you don't get to say goodbye. We need to talk to you. So they started, you know, to talk about Al-Anon. And I had no idea really what Al-Anon was. I should have known, but I didn't. And then the person says, you cannot see your loved one for 2 weeks. And I thought, that's weird. You know, so I went up to them afterward, you know, because why would you not let your family in to help their alcoholic? And I said, you know, I was a little bit irritated. She says, you can't talk to her, you can't call her, you can't see her, nobody can. This is the deal. We want to get to work with them, and you need to go to Al-Anon. You go see you later by driving in the hallway. I said, well, I don't understand this because, you know, she needs me. And the only reason, I said, I'm the reason she's here. And she said, I bet you are. She did. I'm puzzled. You know, I'm puzzled. That Al-Anon look, you know, I don't know what's happening. So, but she did say go to Al-Anon, and I was in such despair that I did, and I started going to meetings. And I kept hearing the same thing over and over again, family disease, family disease, family disease, and I thought this is not a disease, number one. I do not believe alcohol is her choice. That's what she's doing voluntarily. She knows better. She shouldn't be doing it. She's doing it to me. She doesn't care who she hurts with this. That's all those things, you know. So I said it's a family disease, and I thought if it's her disease, it's not mine. And one of the other things that the person at the treatment center said, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I said, why do I need to go to Al-Anon? She says, because you're sick. That's what she said. And I thought, usually people have to know me 2 or 3 weeks before, you know. But she's got this figured out already. So I go to Al-Anon, and I said, well, you know, what the kind of person I am is I read a lot. When somebody says there's something to be learned here, I put myself into it, you know. And I bought all the literature, and I really wanted to know about this family disease thing, because I thought alcoholism had to do with drinking ethanol inappropriately and destroying families and destroying yourself. And I was talking to people at these meetings. My home group is Men at Work, which is in Pleasanton on Wednesdays. I got a couple other meetings too. But I was going to that meeting primarily. I'd gone to other meetings for a couple of years before I started going to that meeting. And my sponsor said, you need to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because our program evolved from the AA program. So I said, okay. So I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, this is a really good book. Gives me some insight into what they're dealing with and what their solutions are. And I remember reading a phrase in the big book that said, our drinking was but a symptom. And that line shocked me. Because if drinking's but a symptom, then there must be something underneath it that drives it. And the drinking is just a manifestation of what's going on, which, you know, now I know is a spiritual malady. You know, emotional issues and the spiritual malady. And someone mentioned that, you know, if you really want to know, look at the 12 steps and look for the word alcohol. So I said, okay, I looked at the 12 steps. I think it was at a meeting at the time, and I counted how many times alcohol is mentioned in the 12 steps. You know, because this is about alcohol, right? And alcohol is only mentioned one of the 12 steps. The rest is about solutions, inventories, amends, higher power, finding God for ourselves, and believing that something can be different for us, some redemption for us and the alcoholic. So some of the literature I got, I'm going to read a few things to you guys, and some of it is research-based, and I know we don't use outside literature, and I absolutely want to abide by that. For a personal share like this, I'm sharing my recovery, and research is an important part of it. But this is from Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, which is one of our books. And this is what I read. Remember, my mission now is to find out what family disease means. And it says, I am a medical director of an addiction treatment facility. I try to teach families that recovery is not just for addicted individuals, but for the whole family. Recovery is manifested by honesty, connected to others, decreased anxiety, trust, and self-worth. Al-Anon allows individuals to experience recovery from the brokenness that is typical of alcoholism. Al-Anon allows individuals to stop playing the game of being the cop in the family, the victim, the protector, the rescuer. It allows people to just be themselves without having to carry the addicted person. In my time with alcoholic families, I point out that by not getting help for themselves through Al-Anon, they will continue a pattern which adversely affects their loved one's potential sobriety. And that struck me. Because when we say now, and I did not know about cause, control, or cure, but contribute, that's what this professional is saying and acknowledging, that I can have an effect on my wife's desire to drink or not by my behavior, how I think, how I approach her, what I tell her to do, what I, you know, my directness, my anxiety. And so, okay, that's family disease. That's what it's talking about. And I read, you know, our reading, The Adult Child of the Alcoholic, was written by Claudia Black, you know, who does a lot of research on alcoholism. This is something else she wrote. An important and overlooked aspect of addiction is the fact that the dysfunctional coping mechanisms and patterns that are developed to deal with the chaos can be passed on through a multi-generational transmission process. The replication and repetition of pathology from one generation to the next is, without intervention and change, automatic. It is a legacy, a heritage, and a family identity. So that doesn't sound like it's just the alcoholic who's sick. And it doesn't sound like, as was shared, that our children are not going to be affected by the dynamics, whether there's a drinker in the family or not. If the dynamics are going on, in my experience, it really doesn't matter if there's a drinker. In my story, which I'll share briefly, in my home growing up, there was no drinking. We did not have an alcoholic to blame. The nearest alcoholic was three generations away. But that was my grandfather, and he really, really affected my mom. And I'll share more about that in a bit. And I also heard alcoholics, you know, I go to open AA meetings because we're supposed to. And I hear alcoholics talk very often about, I was born with a hole in my chest you could drive a truck through. There was something wrong with me. There was something wrong with my family. My interior, as it was shared. And I listened to that, and that's the alcoholic talking, and I thought, that's exactly how I feel. I don't remember ever feeling anything different in my family other than defective. And my brothers felt the same way, and there was a lot of chaos in our home because of the effects of alcoholism. We didn't know it. Nobody knew it. And I was at an Al-Anon meeting, and one of the things that somebody read, I still remember because I wrote it down, is from Chapter 5 of How Al-Anon Works, says, we can see the effects of alcoholism in our lives if we know what to look for. Sometimes we don't recognize alcoholism when it is staring us in the face. It's Chapter 5. And I heard that, and I shared on that. And I said, you know, you're right. Sometimes we don't recognize it when it was staring in our face, because my wife started drinking, you know, and then the drinking got progressively worse, and then it got like that. And somebody said, they're not talking about the alcoholic. They're talking about us. We don't recognize alcoholism in our behavior that's manifested by these dynamics, and even when it's staring us in the face. why do I have the tendencies and the emotional problems that I have and the spiritual maladies and the way I interact with other people? It's because of this step. So, okay, now I'm going, okay, I got this deal. It's a family disease. I buy into that. I'm not sure I have one, though. I'm not sure I have a disease. You all might, but I don't. So I started to look some more, found some more stuff, literature. I remember reading this, and it shocked me. Scared me, actually. And it's this one, the merry-go-round called Denial. This one, great pamphlet. So there's this thing on the enabler, right? So I read this. So it says the first person to appear is one we might call the enabler, a helpful Mr. Clean, who may be impelled by his own anxiety and guilt to rescue his friend, the alcoholic, from his predicament. He wants to save the alcoholic from the immediate crisis and relieve him of the unbearable tension created by the drinking. In reality, this person may be meeting a need of their own, other than that of the alcoholic, although he does not realize it himself. And I thought I was doing this because I love my wife. This is what you do. And then it says, maybe not. Maybe there's some other motive you don't know about. Maybe you're meeting a need of your own. And this is also from Understanding Alcoholism. It's a pamphlet. We fix everything, make excuses, tell lies to mend relationships and worry. We hide how we feel and what we know. That's from Understanding Ourselves in Alcoholism. So deceit is involved in this, withholding information, anxiety and frustration that I transferred to my wife. And, you know, there were times, you know, she would come out and she would have abstinence and her brain would clear. And she would say things to me that I understand now more about my disease and how the drinker and the non-drinker, there's symmetry involved. And as long as that symmetry is existing, it is really difficult to break the cycle of addiction. And she said, you know, why didn't you take your anxiety and your tears and your frustration to Al-Anon? All it did was make, you know, when you cried and you yelled at me and I saw you worrying and I saw you calling and checking up on me, all it did was make me want to drink more. I already felt like a piece of shit. And you confirmed it. Every time I saw you worry, every time I saw you cry, I just wanted to drink some more. And that's what this stuff talks about, this unknown, this hidden stuff that's not apparent to us. And so I started to learn about my disease. And this is also from How Al-Anon Works. What's the purpose of our recovery if we're truly in pursuit of serenity, of healing, of a sense of inner peace that will help us to deal with and possibly even enjoy whatever life brings? We must improve the way we interact with others. And I read that and I go, we, I guess that means me, must improve the way we interact with others, which means that something that I'm doing in my interaction with other people is not very healthy. But it doesn't tell you what you need to change. You know, what is it? I need to improve the interact with, maybe I need to call her more often. You know, maybe I need to take her back into treatment again. No, it doesn't tell you. How Al-Anon Works is interesting. Some people shared this. You know, this book's a great book. It says How Al-Anon Works. You read it cover to cover. It doesn't tell you how it works. You know, this mystical thing, we must improve the way we interact with others. That's mystical. You ever been to one of those escape rooms, you know, they have now? I don't know if you've been to them where you get clues and you go to the next door and they find a key and you do all this other stuff. And that's, you know, it doesn't say. But one of our speakers talked about it, you know, Father Tom, who I really like, said for some people, the Al-Anon victory is speaking up. People who have not had a voice and co-signed on inappropriate treatment. And for some people, the Al-Anon victory is shutting up. And it might change from day to day. You know, and so that's what they're talking about. We don't know how to show affection or support without giving advice, seeking to sway another's decisions, or trying to get those we love to do what we think will bring them happiness. We confuse caring with controlling. We are terrified to let others do as they wish. We have come to believe that our help is imperative. The alcoholic becomes more and more dependent. And that, I'm seeing whistles and bells go off and I'm getting scared. Because I thought, am I trying to make my wife dependent upon me? That's what I learned in my family of origin. You do something for everybody. It looks sweet. It looks kind. All this other stuff. In some way, it's a manipulation. I'm just telling you this because I love you. I'm just doing this because I care about you. And it conveys a message to that person that they can't function on their own. And they already believe it anyway. And it convinces them that you need me. I'm the one. I'll give you the help you need. So I created that situation. I created dependency in my wife. And looking back on it, I know I did it. And I did it unconsciously, but I did it nonetheless. And the idea is that if, you know, I chop off somebody's legs, they're not going anywhere. She would never leave me. And I heard it at a meeting. It was a meeting in Danville on a Monday afternoon. And there was a circle. They met in a circle at this meeting. And there was only one other guy in the room. And they were talking about some topic, you know, about, you know, obsessions, fear, whatever it was. And the man said, and I was fairly new to that meeting, the man said, and he was in the circle and he's sitting down, and he said, there's something that everyone in this room knows an alcoholic who's dependent will never do. And he looked around and he pointed fingers. We all know this. An alcoholic will never do this. Dependent alcoholic will never leave. They will never leave. Which means that my behavior, unconsciously or consciously, to get her to need me and to satisfying, that's what you know, the merry-go-round was talking about. Satisfying a need of your own, although you don't know it. And, you know, and I thought I knew what was best for my wife, and all it did was incapacitate her. And there was, my disease, how it showed up one time during the course of our marriage, right? And I shared this at another meeting. Is that I was doing my task in our family was my task was doing the finances, right? And I said, I don't want to have to pick all these stocks. You know, it's a huge burden on me. It's a labor on me. She was never familiar with it. I said, I want you to take half of this responsibility for this. This shouldn't be mine. You need to do this. My idea, right? I'm going to help her, right? She says, I don't want to do it. I said, well, I want you to do it. It's not fair. So we divided our assets. I don't know, it wasn't a ton of money, maybe $50,000 or something. Not that that's not a lot of money, but. And so she took her share and I took my share and I invested it and she invested it. And then the statements start coming in, right? So I said, let's open these statements. So I look at it and I go, mine's pretty good. Let's see yours. She opens them up, not doing so well. And I said, you know, I think you need to, you know, maybe look at some other stocks and find some other investments, you know. And she said, and we were sitting at a kitchen table, I still remember it, she threw the statement at me across the table. She says, that's exactly why I didn't want to do this. I knew you'd find something wrong with it. And she says, I think I'll go upstairs and have a drink because I know I can do that right. And she did. Now, am I responsible for her choice to drink? Absolutely not. Did I contribute to her feelings of inadequacy? And by convincing her that I'm the guru, I'm the Yoda, I'm the Merlin, you just hang around me, I'll be able to do this. She'll never develop her own self-confidence. She doesn't get to make her own mistakes. She never gets to experience, you know, errors and consequences because I stood in the middle of all of that. And that is how the cycle, the dynamics continue to inflict this kind of damage. And why a drinker, in this case my wife, became feeling horribly about herself. So my family of origin was, my mom was, as I mentioned, an untreated Al-Anon. She was born in Louisiana in 1918. My dad was born in 1919. And my mom, and I didn't understand the significance of this at the time, but my mom said, you know, daddy was an alcoholic. And he was a bastard, and he beat my mother. He was just a drunk. I hated him. Beat my mother all the time. I had to watch him beat me. I'd get in the middle of it, he'd beat my ass, too. I hate him. I still hate him. You know, he was a drunk. He spent all the money. We had no money. She had to quit school at age 13, get a job. And it was right around the Great Depression, right? She was raised around the Great Depression. She didn't have anything. People who promised to help them, you know, disappeared because they had their own problems. And so my mom never, she never got her needs met. She never felt like anybody loved her. Her mother couldn't protect her. There was no laws about domestic violence that existed in that time. They didn't even have a telephone. So every day for however long she lived there, 20, 21 years, 22 years, she had to do that. She had to go through that experience. It was horrible for her. And she made it very clear that we were not going to be like her father. When she'd get mad at I have two brothers, she'd call us, Tom Womack was his name, says, "You're not going to be Tom Womack today. You think you're going to be Tom Womack around here? You got another thing coming. I went through that shit once. And I'm not going through it again. So we're getting this, little kids. The effects of alcoholism, generationally transmitted, uninterrupted." So, but she was angry, she was despondent, she probably was mentally ill. That's what it felt like. And we became her caretaker. I became her caretaker. I became the person who would solve her problems for her, because I'd come home from school, and I remember this happening more than once, and I'd walk in and she'd be on her knees in the kitchen crying for no reason. And so what do you do? I'm a kid, you know, help her. So I walk over and put my arm around her, and I said, "Mom, you okay? You okay?" "Yeah, I'm okay, baby. You know, I'm okay, I'm okay." And I had to put, and I said, "You're the best mom, Mom. You're the best mom. You're the best mom in the world." So I started lying to her because it made her life better. That is the start of a dynamic that's not very healthy in relationships. And she would talk about her arguments with a neighbor, so I'd be her therapist. What happened today between you and Mrs. Radman? Oh, it was this, that. And I'd walk home and I knew what the atmosphere was going to be like. I could tell whether she was going to be happy. So I'd volunteer to do chores. I'd do whatever it took to make her happy. And, you know, I'd mow the lawn. I'd do all these things because my antenna about somebody in distress are so high that, and these dynamics get embedded in our family. And the dynamic is anticipation of other people's needs. I need to, whatever you need, I'm going to do that. It's going to solve a problem for you. I love you so much. You're going to straighten out. And then she would correct, and I would get my needs met from this correction. I did it. I found the key to the lock. Right? And these trends were happening, and I didn't know the dynamics of it all. My brothers were doing the same thing, but I was primarily the one. And it showed, I showed up one day. She's, you know, I just shared the story a few times, but she was giving herself a perm in the sink. They had a big concrete sink in the washroom, right? Remember those? Nobody remembers. So she's been over there, and she's got spoolies in her head. She's trying to give herself a Tony perm, right? Remember Tony perms? And I'm a kid, and I'm like, okay, Mom needs to be happy. Mom needs, I don't know how or why this happened. I said, "Mom, what are you doing?" She says, "I'm giving myself a perm." And she said, "I always thought my, you know, my mom could do it. But, you know, my bastard father was always beating her up, so she didn't have the capacity to do anything for this." So I somehow my brain goes, okay, try door number two. And I said, "Do you want to give me one?" And she says, "Sure." Yeah, she said, "Well, no, okay." So I'm, I don't know, all of about six. I don't know. I have blonde hair. So she puts the spoolies in my hair, gives me a perm, takes them out, and I got this big old afro, blonde afro. Right? And I know she's happy, but I hated it. And I hated her for doing it. I thought she should have known better. I'm a boy, you don't do these things. But she's got the disease too. She's not a drinker, but she's got the disease. Boundaries, right? Boundary problems, not telling the truth, not speaking up. I lied. I didn't tell her I didn't want one. There's a lie. You know, not telling the truth, withholding information. Tendencies in alcoholic families, right? That's what we do. Taking care of other people. The idea, we're responsible. We can fix this. You know, my dad comes home, sees a big afro, and he goes, "What the hell happened here?" You know, and so, you know, I love my mom. She, you know, and dad, they both overachieved what, considering their backgrounds, they way exceeded what should have, what they should have been accomplished. They were very, very accomplished at that. But, you know, as a result of this, these dynamics for me, my relationships with women in an intimate way are not very good. I'm great friends with women. I care very much for women, but I expect a woman to always tell me and reject me, tell me what I'm doing wrong, or I have to turn myself inside out to keep them happy. And I talked to my therapist about it. And he said, "Steve, you think everyone you meet wants to give you a perm?" I go, kinda. And he says but you know, he says, you think everybody's gonna give you a perm, and then the other hand is you let somebody give you a perm when they shouldn't. You know, so where's the balance? You know, how's the disease look like? You know, and my mom's desire to be loved and valued and accommodated, that pattern continued well up into our adult lives. For my brothers and I, it drove us crazy. We really, really were really angry with her, but we felt like we had no choice but to accommodate her and take care of her needs. You know, and, you know, it drove me nuts. You know, as I'm an adult, you know, I get married, bringing my wife around, and these are all true stories. And, you know, we had two bathrooms in the house, but, you know, I don't know what the deal was, but, you know, my mom would, you know, I'd be in there brushing my teeth, mom would have to pee, so she'd walk in, she'd hike up her skirt, sit down next to me at the sink and pee. I didn't think anything of it. I thought, this is a little weird. I wonder if this goes on in other homes. You know, I didn't know. But that's, you know, there's no real rules or boundaries. You know, she didn't have any boundaries in her family of origin. If there were boundaries in her family of origin, her father wouldn't have been able to do what he was doing. So, you know, now she's integrated all this stuff, this is all this dynamics. It's just absolutely crazy, you know. And one time, you know, she would tell me what to do, what classes to take, what professions to get in, what promotions to pursue. And it used to drive me crazy, you know, because to me, I was, you know, and then what happens? I do the same thing to my wife. I do the same exact thing that she did to me that I hated. Let me tell you what you need to do. Let me tell you what you shouldn't do. We're having dinner. We used to have dinner with him on Sunday nights. We're having dinner with him on Sunday nights. Sunday dinner. Chris, my ex-wife, and I, and my mom and dad. We're 35. We don't have kids. So my mom says, when are you going to have grandchildren? We noticed you don't have grandchildren. I'm going, here we go again. An Al-Anon relapse. Right? And I didn't have recovery at that point, so I said, well, we've been trying to have kids. I went through in vitro two or three times and paid five or ten, whatever we paid, and I don't think we can have kids. It didn't work out. And at the dinner table, she said, what kind of underwear are you wearing? And I'm really getting pissed, right? But I can't tell her no. I can't tell her because I don't have recovery. Mom, that's none of your business. You know, none of this is any of your business. I love you, but, you know, I'm not going to answer those questions for you. You need to stay on your own acre of land, Mom. You're hop the fence now, and you're just trampling over my tomatoes and marigolds. You know, the metaphor, stay on your own acre of land. Don't hop people's fences. Even with their permission, you don't do it. But I didn't have recovery. And I said, I think I'm wearing boxers. And she said, you know, if you're wearing, you know, tidy whities, they are going to keep your testicles too warm and decrease your sperm production. That might be what's going on. This was at the dinner table. And I was not happy. And my mom, what I know, all she wanted to do was have a solution for herself. She wanted to be loved. She wanted to have a purpose. She wanted to have value. She didn't get it in her family of origin, so she was on a search for it. And that's what she did. And we were able to patch up our relationship before she died. And it was, you know, it was an interesting thing. She was, gosh, in her 70s, I think. And she was saying something, and I had had enough. Finally, I'd had enough. And I said, Mom, if you don't stop this, you will never see me again. And I meant it. And I used some profanities. And she started crying. And every part of me wanted to go, bad Steve, what the hell is the matter with you? And she cried, and I said, I mean it. You have a choice now. You leave me alone. Don't offer me any unsolicited advice like Al-Anons do to everybody. Because it upsets me. And she said, I will work on changing, and she did. And we were able to have a really good relationship. Because I spoke up, which is, you know, Al-Anon recovery, is speaking, you know, saying the truth. Say what you mean what you say, don't say it mean. So there's a lot more to my story, but the idea is that I transferred these same dynamics to my wife. And I did not know I was doing it. And when I got to make my amends, it meant a lot to me to be able to sit down with her and tell her, you know, how sorry I was, you know, that I had treated her the way that I did. And that, you know, in this program, we say, you know, I was told it's none of your business whether your wife drinks or not. And I said, are you crazy? I said, no, it's not. You have no right to tell another human being what to do. You have a right to leave. And to somebody like me who was so dependent on her, I'd rather be decapitated. But you don't have the right to tell her she can't drink. You know, autonomy. You know, and we wound up divorcing. I divorced her because I had reached the stage where I couldn't live with her disease anymore. And I still love her, and a miracle has taken place. I got out of the way, and she nearly died many, many times. But I got out of the way, and, you know, I don't know, the 20th, 21st, 23rd time she went into treatment, it worked. She's been sober 4 years. And I've already moved on in my life. I have a girlfriend and recovered my first relationship in recovery. And I've shared that with her. And I said, I'm going to love you the rest of my life. Can we find a way to care about each other in a way that's reciprocal and in recovery? She's in AA. And now we can have a recovery-based relationship. For a long time, I didn't feel comfortable in Al-Anon because I'd hear these stories about their husbands and wives, and they go into recovery, and now we're happy ever after. And then where was my story? I do want to talk a little bit about the disease of alcoholism, why the neurobiological part of it, because I needed to know that what you were telling me about alcoholism being disease was true. I needed to know it. And I needed to know it in a science-driven way. So I have been researching this stuff and reading everything I get my hand on, medical journals, research. It's all over the place about addiction now because of this opiate crisis, right? So there's a lot of stuff now about addiction. But for those of you who aren't sure, you know, that your alcoholic has a disease, I want to read some neuroscience to you briefly that conveys that alcoholics do not have a choice in this. This is a neurobiological disease. It says, alcoholics have a liver enzyme malfunction, which causes an abnormal buildup of acetaldehyde. The breakdown of acetaldehyde into acetate occurs at about half the rate of normal drinkers. There's an anomaly right there. The genetic difference. The increased buildup of acetaldehyde is highly toxic and attacks heart protein, and in the brain causes bizarre and complicated chemical reactions. Acetaldehyde compromises the function of brain neurotransmitters. Acetaldehyde interacts with brain neurotransmitters to create isoquinolines. For alcoholics, isoquinolines have one characteristic which makes their other properties pale in significance. They act like opiates. So for an alcoholic, genetically alcoholic, they take in alcohol, and I'm drinking, I have two beers, I go, that's fine. For an alcoholic, the effect, the neurobiological and brain chemical effect on them is if they're taking Dilaudid or Demerol or fentanyl or heroin, that's how powerful the effect is for an alcoholic. It is, as was shared, the solution. Things disappear, the hole in the chest gets smaller. So there is a neurobiological difference between me and them. And it continues. And just to share a little bit more, I'm kind of in this field now a little bit. It's kind of a weird, another weird side story. But the idea is that these, you know, when we drink alcohol, these how alcohol is metabolized, it's broken down into isoquinolines, acetaldehyde, and acetate, which are very toxic. They feel bad and everything. But for the normal person, the effects of alcohol mask the toxic effects about the same rate, an hour per ounce of alcohol. So I take a drink, I got isoquinolines and acetaldehyde and acetate too. But the influence, the euphoria masks that. For the alcoholic, they don't metabolize it. It sticks around. So, you know, they have this little, they drink and then they get this spike of, you know, and it goes this way. And they feel good about it, you know. That wears off, I'm okay. Because I've metabolized all these toxins. The alcoholic does not. They're still sitting with isoquinolines, acetate, and also acetate. So they feel distress. So they drink again to relieve the distress. And the neurotransmitter they're talking about in this research is dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter associated with propagation of the species. Dopamine is related to pleasure. Dopamine is released when we have sex, so we make more babies. It's released when we exercise, so we build up strong so we can have more sex, so we can have more babies. Dopamine is released when we get complimented and hugged and cared for. You know, dopamine is designed to make us feel okay. It's letting us know that we're on the right track. Well, alcohol releases dopamine in everyone. Okay, but for alcoholics, the dopamine release is enormous. There's another genetic anomaly. It's way up here. I'm up here. I'm feeling pretty good. For them, it's way up here, the dopamine release. And so I'm staying around general functioning when I drink. They get this huge dopamine release, huge euphoria. Mimics opiates now, right? They're injecting heroin, right? They drop back down here, isoquinolines and acetate and acetaldehyde, and they take it another again with this huge dopamine release. So they do this, this, and this. And now I understand why my wife, when she started drinking, would not stop. And in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a big book of alcohol, they talk about craving. That's what craving is. And the cruel hoax for alcoholics is that after dopamine is artificially created and artificially stimulated, the body stops producing dopamine. So a lot of alcoholics, when they stop drinking, when they talk about going into withdrawals, what happens is they get depression. And dopamine, it takes a long time for the brain to reorganize itself and brain chemistry to get back to normal. And it talks about medically super. I could talk a lot more about this, but I think it's important to know as Al-Anons that this is not a choice in how the genetic, the byproducts of what happened for an alcoholic is not a choice issue. And there's a thing, a lot of research on supervised, medical release. I want you to know that because I read these things about, I was able to prevent some pretty horrible things from happening because I read this stuff. One time after we were divorced, I know my wife would stay in and she'd binge drink and she'd lock the doors and I wouldn't hear from her at all. And I knew enough to not interfere and not go check, don't keep checking up on the alcoholic, right? So I left her alone. I would make it worse. So, one day she drunk, she called me and said, I need to go to the hospital. Will you take me to the hospital? And my brain goes, okay, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? What would Al-Anon do? You know, I don't want to relieve her of the consequences of her action, but I am willing to take her to the hospital. So I took her to this hospital for a medically supervised detox. And they wheeled her in, and I remember the intake. It was heartbreaking. She had ataxia and dyskinesia, which is shaking of the hands and instability, even when they're not drunk. They lose the ability to walk. So she walks in. The nurse says, I'm sitting by her side. I can do this without taking care of her, without being her solution. There's a difference. And so why are you here? And she says, I'm a drunk. And I'm going through withdrawals. So they take her to the back room. And they give her an IV. Alcohol, by the way, depletes our body of vitamins, so they have to do a vitamin supplements to get an alcoholic back into a normal place. So they give her benzodiazepines, and they hydrate her, and they do some sort of vitamin supplement thing. And then the doctor says, we'll get you out of here in a couple hours. You'll be okay. And I said, I'm an Al-Anon. I read this stuff. So I said, doctor, can I talk to you? And he says, sure. I said, I know all about medically supervised detox. And 2 hours, 3 hours is not going to be enough to stabilize her. That's just putting a Band-Aid on it, getting her out the door. I'm not telling you what to do, but I will tell you that I know this. And if you do this and there's an incident, I will litigate this. And he said, I understand. I'll keep her here for 2 days. And they did. Okay. And I was also told, to get firearms out of my house. For those of you, and there are some of you in the room living with active alcoholism, and my profession that I was in, I carried a firearm. And when we separated, I just left quickly. And we had a file cabinet with a lock on it. And I locked the file cabinet with a couple of pistols that I had. I carried guns at work. I had to. And I was at a meeting, and it was an AA open A meeting, and this guy was talking about guns. And he said, San Quentin is filled with people during blackouts who killed relatives. So if you got guns, get rid of them. I go home. And because she had gone to work, and I go home, and I go, okay, I'd safely go in there and get those guns. She had pried open the cabinet, and the guns were gone. I had no idea where they went. And I asked her, I said, where did they go? And she says, I don't know. She blacked out. And so I got two handguns somewhere. So about 10, 15 years later, we are divorced. She's got some sobriety. She's having the deck repaired, and the two guns are underneath the deck. She threw them under the deck, has no memory of it. So get rid of firearms. Last thing I'll tell you about in terms of safety with alcoholics is when she was going through another occasion, I had to take her to the ER. Her brother was with me. I didn't have to take her. I chose to take her to the ER to get her medically supervised detox. And she was, you know, alcoholics or stage 3 alcoholics, their brain function is really, really impaired. They're incompetent. And she was, and I got her on, I made a mistake. So I got on the freeway and I'm going north on 680 going towards Kaiser, about 65 or 70 miles an hour, and I heard trying to get out the car. And I locked the button just in time. I heard her fiddling around and I looked back and she was trying to get the handle jump out of the door on the freeway. So bear these things in mind if you're living with active alcoholism. There are things that we should be doing and things that we should not be doing. And I'll tell you, the only reason I know that is because I came here and you told me to learn the facts about alcoholism and to take messages from these meetings. Last thing I'll say, I'll let you guys have a real fun Saturday night. About the generational piece of transmission and how it affects our kids, because it does. You got to get kids into treatment. Kids get mentally ill around this stuff. So I am now a therapist. I'm a licensed therapist. I quit one job, and I have a contract with Children and Family Services in Contra Costa County. I work with domestic violence cases, and that's what I do. And because I work with domestic violence cases, guess what shows up all the time? Alcoholism. So they asked me to interview this one little kid, he's probably about 6, whose father was drinking and his wife was upset with her drinking. So they got in a scuffle and the police came out and arrested him. And the police reported it as, because domestic violence is child abuse, to report it to CPS. They asked me to, you know, have mom bring in the son, bring in this little boy. Will you interview this little boy? And I said, sure. So they interviewed the little boy. I'm interviewing the little boy, and I said, how are things at home? He says, it's okay, except when my dad drinks, my mom doesn't like it. And I said, well, what do you do? And he says, well, I can tell when my dad gets upset, so I make him better. Okay, how do you make him better? How do you do that? And he says, I bring him a newspaper, his slippers, and a beer. And that works. So I already know from 25 years in Al-Anon what is getting embedded in this kid. Is a pattern of taking care of someone, taking care of their needs, and not being concerned about his own needs and not being able to be honest with it. So I think I'm done. I'm sorry it took so long. So I apologize.